Great. Are we ready to roll?
I think we're good. We have probably a little bit more than half of our members present.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and start. Welcome everyone to the October 26, 2020 Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee meeting, also known as DPIC. I'm Susan Tatayan, Chair of the Delta Stewardship Council, and I also serve as Chair of DPIC. I'm glad to be able to be with you all remotely today. For those tuning in to a DPIC meeting for the first time, I'll give a quick overview of how this committee came to be. The 2009 Delta Reform Act required the Delta Stewardship Council to establish and oversee a committee of agencies responsible for implementing the Delta Plan. Since its first meeting in April 2014, DPIC has served as a forum to strengthen collaboration among federal, state, and local agencies that manage natural resources in the Delta. It is one of the few forums to generate public dialogue about opportunities to align agencies' actions in the Delta watershed, showcase DPIC agencies' achievements, and drive actions to address pressing issues affecting the Delta Plan implementation. With that, I'll ask Amanda Bull to introduce the DPIC members who are with us today.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. So I'm going to just read off the names of the DPIC members who I see that have joined us already. And at the end, if I have missed you and you've joined us since then, please let us know that you're here. We have Oscar Villegas from the Delta Protection Commission, Larry Goldband from BCDC, Mike Chakowski, USGS, Brian Thompson from the US EPA, Tim Ramirez from the Central Valley Flood Protection Board, Kaylee Allen representing U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Carla Nemeth from California Department of Water Resources, Kathy Marcinovich for NOAA, Joaquin Esquivel from the State Water Resources Control Board, Cindy Tejeda, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Josh Grover from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, Amrith Gunasekera from the California Department of Food and Agriculture, Campbell Ingram from the Delta Conservancy, Laurel Larson, Delta Lead Scientist, Kristen Peer from the Cal EPA, and Dave Mooney representing Reclamation. Let me just make sure I don't see anyone else on here. I don't think so. So if I did not call your name, please introduce yourself now. Otherwise, I think we're good.
Yeah, Ernest Conant from Reclamation is also on.
Great, thank you.
And Wade Crowfoot from the Natural Resources Agency in California.
Great, thank you. All right, I think we're good, Chair Tatayan.
Great, thank you. Thank you all for being here with us today. If any members have a quick 30-second announcement, an update that you'd like to share, or if you have comments on the July 13 DPIC meeting summary, let's go ahead and hear from you now. And let's use either the raise hand or the chat to let Amanda know if you have an announcement or a comment on the meeting summary.
Looks like we have an announcement from Josh Grover from CDFW.
Great. Hi, Josh.
Yeah, hi, thanks. Just a quick update. The Frank's Track final project report was posted, and it's now available on the department's website for those that are interested.
Congratulations.
I don't see any more raised hands.
Okay. Well, a moment for a quick instructions for public comment. If any member of the public is interested in providing public comment, please send an email blue card to the clerk at engage@deltacouncil.ca.gov. Be sure to note your name and the agenda item that you wish to comment on, and please note if you wish to speak or would like the clerk to read your comment. please do this as soon as possible so there is time to have you join the meeting. After your name is called, the clerk will unmute you or read your comment if requested. So let's move on to agenda item 2, developing a bold strategy for forward-looking science in the face of rapid environmental change. At our last EPIC meeting, Dr. Steve Brandt shared with us some highlights from the series of panel discussions held to lead up to the Science Needs Assessment Workshop. And today, he will share highlights of the workshop that took place October 5 and 6. So Mike Chalkowski from the U.S. Geological Survey will be joining Dr. Brandt.
Okay, thanks, Susan. Can we have the first slide? Great. Well, thanks for the invitation. And today, Mike and I would just like to give you sort of a brief update of what happened at the workshop and a little background to that, to how we got to where we are now and where we're going to go. So next slide. As a reminder, this effort was triggered by a letter that the Delta Independent Science Board sent to DPIC back in February of 2019, suggesting that strategic science needs assessment and other things needed to be done. And this is actually very unusual for, I think it's the first time ever that the Delta Independent Science Board sent a letter directly to DPIC and making a request. So really appreciate DPIC's support on this. And as you know, in last November, DPIC included the science needs assessment as a priority action in the Delta Science Funding and Governance Initiative. And that triggered us to move forward on a workshop, which, and I'll talk a lot about the workshop, but I also wanted to remind folks that the Delta Independent Science Board has continued that discussion of rapid environmental changes and the scientific needs through a variety of meetings and panels that we had over the course of the last year, including a discussion paper that has been through a number of revisions. And it was 2 weeks ago or so, it was submitted to the San Francisco Estuary and Watershed Science Journal. And it's entitled Preparing for a Fast Forward Future in the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta. And it really talks about that issue in a really far broader context than what we're talking about it today in terms of specifically climate change and the science needs workshop. So the next slide. So as background in that letter, we entitled the letter, The Urgency and Opportunities for Improving Delta Interagency Science and Technology Integration. So that integration component is a real important aspect of the science needs assessment and really what the strategic goals we are talking about. We pointed out that environmental conditions are changing at a increasing rate, not only with climate change, but also sea level rise, new invasive species, shifts in land use, increasing demands for water. And this is occurring in the Delta, but it's occurring in many ecosystems throughout the globe. Many of these changes, of course, are interactive with each other. We suggest that a bolder, forward-looking, and better integrated science program is needed to address these Delta challenges, which routinely span the mandates of multiple agencies. And that requires scientific leadership and vision, some identification of some of the major strategic science priorities, and lastly, to explore the structures that might be available to enhance interagency science integration. The next slide. Also in that letter, one of the recommendations was to develop a comprehensive strategic science needs assessment. We suggested it need to be based on fundamental system-wide scientific and management challenges that face the Delta, particularly related to climate change. That it should identify future Delta conditions and changes in fundamental driving forces, to identify science needs to forecast and predict how the Delta might change under these conditions. We stress the importance of stakeholder engagement throughout this process, and also that multi-agency effort is needed to provide the leadership and sort of an effective structure to create that scientific and technology integration. So with that and DPIC's endorsement, back in November, we created a planning team, and the next slide shows the members of that planning team, which is a fairly diverse group of individuals with the charge of developing a workshop and running an actual strategic science needs assessment. The workshop, as you all know, was originally scheduled for last April. As part of preparation for that workshop, we developed a briefing paper that described environmental change, the rationale for the need for the science needs assessment, how science needs assessments are done, and what the various components of a science needs assessment might be. With the next slide, given that we couldn't meet because of COVID, we decided to postpone the workshop until October, but in the meantime, to not lose momentum, was to explore each of the four primary topics that were considered to be topics of the originally proposed April workshop. And they flow one from the other. These discussion groups were on four different dates. They were only an hour long. We had a panel, of which some of you participated in the panel. The panel gave a discussion of the topic, but then a lot of the discussion was an actual discussion with members of the audience, which included stakeholders and government and state agencies, NGOs, academics, and actual stakeholders. And we got their input, very creative input, from Mentimeter questions. We had probably about 100 participants in each of these four workshops, and the topics started out with, what do we know about the projected climate changes impacts in the Delta? What are we fairly assured is going to happen? And once we know that, given that, what questions does that raise for management decisions? What will managers need to know in order to effectively manage in those future conditions, realizing that some of those future conditions are occurring right now in terms of climate change and extremes? Then thirdly, once we know management needs, what are the science needs? What are the science needs to give management answers to the questions that they need to know? What is the science capabilities we need to develop? And then finally, given that scientific capabilities, are we currently organized, funded, and structured in a way to be able to achieve those scientific needs? And if not, what needs to be done to achieve those? Those are very instructive, in my view, very creative, a lot of really good input that came out of those. Each of those discussions are available for you to watch. There are also the reports from those. Three out of the four reports are completed and online for you to look at, which includes the bar graphs of the answers to the Mentimeter questions that we gave for the participants. That provided a really good basis for us to move into the workshop, and the workshop largely focused on the last two questions on this page. If we can go to the next slide. Specifically, we spent one day trying to identify what the key scientific needs, capacity, and tools that would be needed to provide input for management decisions under a changing Delta. We spent the second day discussing if there are ways to better organize the science enterprise to address these complex and changing problems, which again span individual agency mandates and individual agency capabilities. So the first day on what's the needed science, the second day is how do we get there. We had about 140 or so participants, so it was a very large group that participated in these 2 days of workshop, two half days. And we started out, the next slide, with a plenary session, three people who you probably all know, and asked them, what is your advice on developing a science needs assessment? And how can we make the science needs assessment effective for policymakers? The panelists, I won't go into their advice they gave us, but they gave us a lot of good advice. Their charge was to provide stimulation to our discussions, try to get us thinking creatively, thinking broadly, thinking with innovation. And I think they really succeeded in doing that for us, because the workshop, from my view, was of that nature. A lot of really good ideas and a lot of creative and forward-thinking ideas came out of that. The next slide shows the breakout of the first day's session. So again, the first day was focused on the science. What do we need to know to support future decisions? We broke it into 8 topical breakout groups, largely taken from the Delta Plan, covering water supply, flood, habitat management, native species, non-native and invasive species management, water quality issues, land use issues, and Delta as an evolving place. The report back from the answers and input we got from the workshop participants spans at least about 50 pages worth of material. So, and a lot of that is really good. We're in the process now of digesting that material. The next slide. Oh, again, I forgot. This is the detailed questions we asked them. But in essence, it's really focused in the third question is, what scientific capabilities do we need so that science can prepare for future problems, or can prepare for problems that will arise with future environmental change? And we asked that within each of the sort of eight areas. The next slide. On day 2, we focused in on the scientific enterprise itself. After having a full discussion of some of the sort of the complex scientific needs and some of the bold suggestions that came, we asked the question, what do we really need to have to make that happen? So the work groups were divided into these 5 areas. And I think there was, if I recall, there was at least 2 work groups in under each of these. Coordination, funding, institutional change, science, enterprise leadership, and data management. Unfortunately, I'm not going to give you all the results. In fact, I'm not going to give you any results. I'm still digesting all of that. The next slide just outlines some of the next step in the process. We are reviewing the various workshop discussions and material, and to try and make sure we absorb all of the information that the various participants gave to us. And we will, of course, be writing a summary of those reports, but the actual report itself is going to be something a little bit different. And one of the things we're talking about is to provide 3 to 5 sort of strategic and bold priorities, and that having sifted through all the material to come up with the really bold priorities that we think will be valuable to agencies and stakeholders and managers, but also something that will challenge the scientific enterprise and be of use not only as soon as it's developed, but also in the future. We're hoping to draft the report this fall and have something available in early 2021. And of course, the recommendations will come directly back to DPIC, but we've also been working very closely with the Science Action Agenda, and so that our recommendations can feed into some of their more strategic priorities. So that's my coverage, and I'll ask Mike to if he has any thing to add, and of course Mike has agreed to answer all the questions too. So
yeah, thank you, Steve, and good afternoon, everyone. I don't have a lot to add to Steve's summary. I would like to thank Steve, Jay Lund, and the ISB in general, I think on behalf of the Planning Committee, for catalyzing this dialogue, which is one that we need to have. I think we would also all like to thank the Delta Stewardship Council staff for doing their usual excellent job putting on the pre-workshop discussion series, which some of you probably saw, and for putting on the workshop and curating the written products that we have produced and will be producing in the future, as Steve described. What I would like to do is just underline the most important executive level takeaways at this stage, which are that there are 2 follow-up efforts that we're pursuing going forward. One is the inquiry into whether there are science activities that we should undertake or consider undertaking in order to improve science support over the next few decades. I agree with Steve and many others that the potential for rapid changes in hydrology alone may increasingly test the imagination and mettle of policymakers in the coming years. Even if you leave aside other aspects of climate change and the likely more gradual changes in human geography and resource demand that we'll see, it seems likely that most of the recommendations from this part of the follow-up will be technical in nature, and they'll be fed into the science action agenda effort. There might be one or two policy level recommendations from this part of the inquiry that will return to the DPIC. The second area of follow-up is the one that addresses whether the science enterprise covering the Bay Delta and associated watersheds would benefit from refinements to governance or changes in institutions or their relationships to more efficiently use available resources and better achieve the core goal of the science enterprise to inform policy decision making. Based on the expansive dialogue that we had during the pre-workshop discussion series and at the workshop itself, this second area seems likely to lead to one or a few significant recommendations that by their nature would come back to the DPIC, not things that would be channeled into the Science Action Agenda effort. So we, as Steve said, we're digesting what we heard, and that process is going to play out over the fall. And we'll give all these matters careful thought before the final report is completed. I think Steve and I and others on the planning committee look forward to talking with you, the DPIC, about this once that analysis and the recommendations have been formulated. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Steve and Mike. So DPIC members, for the DPIC members who attended the October workshop, I'd like to ask you what some of your main takeaways from the workshop were. Well, maybe. So then I will prompt Ernest Conant, who was generous with his time and took time to offer some observations at the plenary of the workshop. Ernest, would you be willing to give a couple of highlights or insights? Is Ernest? I see Ernest. I see his name on the screen. I think he's still on mute.
Yeah, I just had to step away for a minute.
Oh, hi. Hi, Ernest. So you gave an excellent opening at the plenary, and I was just wondering if you had some thoughts about the October workshop in terms of highlights or your observations about the workshop.
Unfortunately, I wasn't able to stay around very long, but from what I saw, it seemed to be a very productive exercise, and I commend you on all the work you're doing on it.
Great, thank you. Any other DPIC members who were at the workshop have any highlights you want to share?
I'll chime in, Susan. This is Larry Goldspan from BCTC.
Hi, Larry.
How are you?
Hi.
With a witch over my left shoulder there. Sorry about that. That's our son's first grade project, and we think it's so cool that we embarrass him every year as a junior in high school now to put it up. A couple of us, including Mark LaBelle from UC Davis, were very much involved in the governance aspect of this, which I think is really from my perspective as a non-scientist, really a key. And the thing that we have talked about a little bit post-workshop is that there is a vacuum in terms of leading scientific research toward a central goal or a number of goals. And that is because, for the most part, scientists work on what they want to work on and what they think they should work on. And it's not as though we would ever tell people don't work on that. But the question is, how do you provide some type of framework to ensure that the science that goes on in the Delta is leading to some grand conclusion, or even not grand conclusion, or a number of conclusions that, and here's where the governance really starts coming in, that are understandable by policymakers. And that is where Mark and I really want to concentrate as we look at the workshop sessions and read all the notes, which is, how can we ensure that the science that goes on actually leads a policymaker in the legislature or in the administration to get to a point that the legislature and the administration agree on a science framework going forward that gets them the answers they need in light of climate change.
Great. Thank you, Larry. Go ahead.
Oh, and then Kathy has her hand up. Yeah.
Yeah, hi, this is Kathy Marston-Kovich. I'm in for Barry Thom from NOAA Fisheries, and I did attend the 2 days of the workshop, and it was in the native species session, and then I think institutional change or governance for the other one. And it was really rich conversation in both sessions. You know, I want to thank those who made the time to attend and made it a priority to really engage, because I think there was a really great exchange of ideas, you know, and some common themes of desire to move something forward, not necessarily finding, you know, the golden ticket that gets us there. And then, you know, recognizing that we've got like an observational network to kind of build on, and, you know, how can we augment what we have to, you know, to get us to move forward to where we need to be. So just some good takeaways, but I thought it was overall a really productive conversation. I look forward to seeing some of the products that come out of it.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Kathy. It looks like there's a chat here. Am I seeing things correctly, Amanda? Maybe not. I thought someone had something in the chat.
No, there was, but it's not for this, though. So I think I don't see anything in the chat, and I don't see any other hands raised at the moment either.
Okay. Okay, for the DPIC members who weren't at the workshop, what are your thoughts in terms of making science in an age of rapid change more usable for policymakers, getting to Larry's point? How do we move the science not only to address rapid change, but to give policymakers the kind of science you're looking for?
Well, this is Wade Crowfoot. I'm happy to share. Hey there. You know, I think one of the reasons I participated in DPIC and continue to do so is I really do appreciate the goal, which is to bring all of these agencies together to navigate these complicated scientific questions, to inform a cohesive, coordinated approach to stabilizing and restoring the environment in the Delta. And I have to say that as somebody who, you know, ends up having to deal with a lot of issues, and so I'm sort of a mile wide and an inch deep, it's still very hard for me to have my hands or arms around sort of the critical objectives scientific objectives in the Delta that should guide all of our decision making, whether that's, you know, habitat mitigation or use of bond funding for restoration or project development. So, you know, to me, I really do continue to endorse and champion the purpose of DPIC, which is, from my perspective, not only to, you know, sort of move away from disparate, siloed, at worst kind of compliance or combat science to collaborative science that really we can use as policymakers. And I do have to say that, you know, I would continue to really ask for distillation from the scientists, recognizing it is, because it's such a biologically rich region that is frankly so altered by human engineering. I can understand that there are myriad questions and topics and uncertainties, but to me, success, you know, of DPIC and of the our joint science program would be something that people like me can really understand, almost like Delta Science for Dummies, where, okay, here are the five things that we're, you know, working to accomplish in the Delta, and we can create criteria for everything that we're doing through a set of distilled priorities. So I'll stop there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Wade. That was something that Felicia Marcus actually was encouraging at the workshop. She talked about focusing on scenarios. What are some of the scenarios that will inform the science and the policymakers as to the urgency of the science? So I appreciate the word distillation. Any other
last
comments?
Thing I'd say, maybe, and then I'll cede, is I just want to, and I don't think we're doing this necessarily, but let's avoid, paralysis by analysis. We know, our biodiversity challenges are getting more complicated. We know climate change is on the march and will impact the Delta. I've always been a big fan of trying to figure out working together on various sort of scientific collaborations and then managing adaptively based on what we learn. So obviously I didn't come up with that idea, but as I've been educated by people, that's something that's really resonated with me. Let's not, make the perfect the enemy of the good, but let's get in there and let's do things that we think are going to benefit the environment and the ecology and then modify as needed.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Wade. Are there any other comments from DPIC members?
Is it Oscar?
Hi, Oscar.
Hello. Yeah, I wanted to just follow up a little bit with Wade's comments, and I think that makes complete sense. I think it's high time that we really do get a cohesive, coordinated, distilled, if you will, framework for what science we ought to be focused on and what impacts it'll have. Maybe the question I have is that I know, we're anxiously waiting, some recommendations or a recommendation on how we can further this objective, the goal. But I wondered if in the process of providing some recommendations, we can think about it a couple different ways. Obviously one might be a more coordinated governance structure so that the funding mechanisms are more tailored to affect the policy issues more directly. But then conversely, I think oftentimes another set of recommendations or a recommendation might be how the existing funding streams could adopt a policy framework that then allows those funding streams to more focus, more specifically focus its efforts or their efforts on the framework that has been identified, as going forward. And the reason I want to offer that the latter recommendation is that I think, one of the things that I've seen in my 35 years in state government has been, despite the fact that I'm currently on the Board of Supervisors, is that during the course of these exercises to try to more bring together, if you will, different funding streams, because they're kind of all over the map in terms of different agencies and different requirements, is that exercise is incredibly difficult. Not to say it couldn't be done, but it's incredibly difficult. And I wondered if there is and DPIC's a perfect opportunity, and maybe I'm stating the obvious, but DPIC, I think, serves as a perfect opportunity to have all of the respective agencies adopt the recommendation so that the funding streams respectively throughout the course of the path that we could focus our efforts on those rather than trying to do the former, which is much more difficult, if that's even being talked about. So I might have missed what was being referred to in terms of the recommendation, but I offer that as a path going forward that I think is sometimes needs to be looked at. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Oscar. No, I like the idea of having the actual policy questions, the management questions, focus the science and focus the funding. Well, if there are no other DPIC members,
actually, Susan, sorry, it's Amanda. It looks like Joaquin Esquivel and Laurel Larson both have their hands raised as well.
Oh, okay. Joaquin?
I was actually just going to flag and add that to Oscar's point, the exercise that we've been undertaking with DPIC to do just that, catalog and look at our different expenditures, at least at this point, and at the very front end, try to at least make sure we're capturing the scale and scope of scientific activity and research that's going on in ways that can at least let us get a sense of the current activities. And then from there, where are the ways that we can better ensure that agencies are sort of focusing on one aspect of a management question, perhaps, or know that another agency is lead in that space, and so that we don't have at least a duplication or a duplicative sort of effort going on. Note that as well, though, that a lot of the at least reporting or monitoring requirements are sometimes tied to permits as well. So there's different ways that I think ultimately, at least the cataloging of all this is going to lead to these follow-on opportunities to better align it. So just wanted to flag that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Joaquin, for the reminder. It's a major effort. Dr. Larson.
Thank you, Susan. I also just wanted to respond to Oscar and to flag the point that right now the Delta Science Program is embarking on a renewal of the Science Action Agenda, excuse me, which is being based around management questions that we have amassed by reaching out to the community and partner agencies. And this is the document that will drive the funding of science in the next several years. I think one of the things that's very much a topic of discussion right now is how we combine the longer term outlook that was the focus of discussion at the Science Needs Assessment Workshop with these shorter term questions and shorter term management needs. And so this is something that I think that the DPIC can really weigh in on. And then the other thing I just wanted to bring up was a topic that was brought up by Peter Goodwin in his plenary session on the idea of forming a Delta Science Collaboratory, which would potentially be an independent entity that provides a more formal structure to collaboration around science and management needs within the Delta. And this is something that generated a lot of excitement at the Science Needs Assessment Workshop. And I think will be a topic of continued discussion.
Yes. Thanks, Dr. Larson. Yes, the collaboratory has a lot of fans. And
yeah.
Well, let's move on. We're under a time constraint here. Are there any public comments on this item?
Chair, there are no public comments.
Great. Thank you, Eric. Well, in that case, thank you very much to Dr. Brandt and Mike Truskowski, and we look forward to hearing from you once the report is completed.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So on to our next agenda item. Jeff Henderson, our Deputy Executive Officer for Planning, will be giving us the context and background for our next agenda items, Recreating a Climate Resilient Future. We've got an excellent panel. So, Jeff, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Tatayan. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jeff Henderson. I'm the Deputy Executive Officer for Planning at the Delta Stewardship Council. And today we're going to have a panel that's going to be addressing rapid climate change. And as California continues, as we know, to experience climate change through hotter temperatures, more severe wildfires, and prolonged droughts, regional adaptation that's rooted in science is more critical than ever. Today, we're first going to explore the current context for regional adaptation planning and implementation through some projects initiated by two DPIC member agencies in the Delta and in the San Francisco Bay. Then, we'll think a bit about what future collaborative regional adaptation across this interconnected Bay Delta system might look like, what the current administration's priorities and strategic direction for climate change are, and a number of opportunities for DPIC members to collaborate on climate resilience efforts in the Bay Delta region. As you know, Governor Newsom recently signed a Nature-Based Solutions Executive Order, Order N8220, to boost near-term climate resilience efforts by, among other things, setting a goal for the state to conserve at least 30% of California's land and coastal waters by 2030. That executive order directs state agencies to develop and report strategies to the governor no later than February 1st of 2022 in order to achieve this goal. Now, while there's important work yet to be done to implement that executive order and to achieve the 30 by 30 objective, both of the projects you'll hear about today have the potential to meaningfully contribute to that goal. Our discussion first addresses an ongoing climate adaptation planning project for the Delta, known as Delta Adapts, that's led by the Delta Stewardship Council. Our staff's been working on this for well over 2 years, and we're really excited to share those results with the DPIC today. We'll then expand our geographic scope to consider the Adapting to Rising Tides and the Bay Adapts processes that are led by BCDC to build regional support and buy-in for implementing climate adaptation strategies. We'll then conclude by summarizing the governor's high-priority, near-term climate change objectives under the executive order and begin to consider and discuss how those objectives might be achieved in the Bay Delta region through the participation of DPIC member agencies. These efforts are a great example of regional partners working together to advance climate solutions. This is necessary, in part, because no single actor has jurisdiction or authority to compel the scope and pace of the action and change that's needed on its own. The DPIC has an important role to play in forging these collaborative and regional solutions to resilience and the challenges that the Bay Delta system faces. And DPIC has a great opportunity to do so in the context of the executive order. So today our speakers include Harriet Ross, who's the Assistant Planning Director at the Delta Stewardship Council, who will address the Delta Adapts program. She'll be followed by Jessica Fain, who is the Planning Director at the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, who will address the Adapting to Rising Tides and the Bay Adapt programs. And Jessica will be followed by Amanda Hansen, the Deputy Secretary for Climate Change at the California Natural Resources Agency, who will update the committee members on Governor Newsom's high-priority efforts around climate change. And following their presentations, we'll have some time for questions and discussions on this very important topic. So with that, up first is Harriet.
Thank you, Jeff. Good afternoon, Chair Tatayan, members of the DPIC. Again, I'm Harriet Ross, Assistant Planning Director with the Delta Stewardship Council. I'm very pleased to present on the Council's climate initiative, Delta Adapts, today. This effort has been significant and ongoing for over 2 years, and I want to acknowledge the efforts and thank the team of the Planning and Performance Division and Science Program here at the Council to getting us to this point. Next slide, please. Delta Adapts consists of two phases, a vulnerability assessment and adaptation strategy, We're currently working on the vulnerability assessment now and anticipate having a draft out later this year. We will be talking about our process and sharing our draft findings today. An overarching goal of Delta DAPS is to build climate resilience in the Delta. Next slide. We wanted to study climate change vulnerabilities of the Delta with the specific goals of informing future Delta plan amendments and implementation, helping the state to prioritize future actions and investments, providing a toolkit of information for local governments to use in their regulatory documents, and to serve as a framework to be built upon by the Council and others in the future. Next slide, please. Delta DAPS is a regional study. We cover a large area, the entire Delta and Sassoon Marsh, shown here in red on the map. And this area is consistent with our regulatory authority. It is a planning level study designed to inform policy. Now, a lot of other climate assessments have been done by state agencies and individual cities and counties in the Delta, but these typically focus on assets those agencies own or analyze vulnerabilities based on certain conditions. Now, Delta DAPS is different in that it covers a broad range of asset categories and climate change conditions and is really designed to be complementary with these other efforts. Next slide. Now, our study looks at a different range or a range of climate stressors and hazards, including changes in air temperatures, precipitation, and sea level rise. And we also analyze vulnerabilities related to extreme heat, wildfire, drought, and flooding. Next slide. We have conducted an extensive stakeholder engagement program. We had ongoing collaboration with agency partners, many of which are on this call and members of the DPIC. We built off of existing models and data created by our partners and worked extensively to ensure future flood studies are generally consistent. We also had a series of stakeholder briefings where we met with stakeholders to ground truth our data and verify our results. And we launched a significant effort to outreach to community-based organizations who helped us structure our engagement to reach vulnerable communities in the Delta. We also formed a technical advisory group consisting of experts in the system and in climate change who provided input on our technical approach and analyses every step of the way. We've also engaged a stakeholder work group, which consists of local agencies, cities, counties, environmental groups, just to name a few, that provided data and input into our initiative. And we plan on continuing this level of engagement until we are done with the vulnerability assessment, anticipated to be early next year, and then expanding that engagement as we begin our adaptation strategy. Next slide, please. We prepared a series of technical analyses to support the vulnerability assessment, and we'll be presenting the results of our equity analysis and the key findings related to flooding, water supply, and ecosystem today. So moving forward to the equity analysis, if you can skip the slides, please. Through our equity analysis, we did a literature review and talked with other agencies that had addressed equity in their own climate studies. And through this process, we identified a set of factors that would affect people's vulnerability to flooding, extreme heat, and wildfire. So, for example, having a pre-existing health condition makes a person much more sensitive to the climate hazards we looked at. Or someone's ability to evacuate from their home, if they have a car, for example, affects their capacity to respond to floods and wildfires. Next slide. We then reviewed these factors with several community-based organizations and refined our list. This list was used to develop a custom social vulnerability index for the Delta to identify those communities that have multiple intersecting concentrations of these factors that we have defined to increase vulnerability. We use this index to identify geographic areas with multiple indicators, and the communities with the highest social vulnerability to climate change are shown there on the map in dark orange. We can also use this index to prioritize where we implement adaptation strategies to address our climate vulnerabilities, ensure adaptation is occurring equitably in the Delta, and ensure we're helping those communities with less ability to respond to climate change. Next slide, please. Now, moving on to flood hazard. Our flood modeling builds upon previously developed tools by others, especially the Department of Water Resources, and it considers a wide range of future climate change conditions. Our model allows us to understand what drives flooding and how the entire Delta system and its levees will respond to these future conditions. It is also flexible to changing data. I should also mention, our flood analysis only looks at overtopping of levees, and it does not assume any future improvements to the levees or upstream mitigation. Those approaches could represent good adaptation in the future for us to consider. So now, moving on to the next slide, and I'm going to be showing a series of three flood maps. And for current conditions, that's what you see on the map here. At current conditions, much of the Sassoon Marsh is exposed to flooding. No surprise, that area is shown in dark blue. But only about 10% of the Delta's area would be exposed to levee overtopping by a 100-year event. And so most of these flooded parts are ecosystems that we want to flood at high frequencies or areas with known deficiencies. And these flooded areas contain about 2% of the Delta's 625,000 people, but of that, over 3,000 people, or 24% of those affected areas, live in communities with high social vulnerability to climate change. And now the next slide shows 2050 climate conditions. We start to see substantial additional flooding throughout the Central and South Delta. Notably, we see overtopping with much smaller storm events, so it's not just that more land is being exposed to flooding, it's that it doesn't take nearly as rare an event to see substantial flooding. So the dark colored areas on the map represent areas exposed to flooding during a 10 to 50 year event, so a level of flood risk that could make agricultural investment challenging. In addition, there are several urbanized and urbanizing areas that are exposed to flooding under this expected condition, increasing the potential for significant economic disruption and loss and impacts to socially vulnerable populations. So by the numbers, over 10% of the Delta's population, nearly 65,000 people, would be exposed to flooding during a 100-year event, of which 42,000 of those people are living in communities that are highly socially vulnerable to flooding. That represents about 65% of the total exposed population. Now, moving on to the next slide, the 2085 conditions. So by late century, most of the South and Central Delta are exposed to flooding on a less than 10-year reoccurrence. So in other words, there's a 65% chance of these areas flooding over a 10-year period towards the later part of the century. At a 100-year storm event, 20% of the Delta's population, or roughly 120,000 people, would be exposed to flooding. Again, over half, or 71,000 people, are living in a highly socially vulnerable area. And during a 200-year storm event, approximately 44% of the Delta's population would be exposed. And again, more than half of those folks are located in the Stockton and Pocket area of Sacramento. And this highlights that targeted adaptation investments could really protect tens of thousands of people from flooding. And you can see that areas of the North Delta remain relatively secure, even with these substantial climate changes. And this highlights the value of past flood management investments along the Sacramento and American rivers, and most importantly, the Yellow Bypass. Next slide here shows the insights that we gain from our modeling. And the areas of the green are where flooding is driven by flows from the rivers in red, sea level rise in green, and where flooding is driven by both factors, which is shown in blue. So this is a really important insight as part of the study, because now we understand that adapting to sea level rise, which involves a different set of strategies and options and adapting to higher Delta inflows, is a major driver of flooding in the Delta. Next slide. So what does this all mean? We already knew that there were a lot of the part of the Delta would flood with expected changes in climate conditions, and we knew the flooded areas, or we suspected the flooded areas would disproportionately affect vulnerable communities. But now we have an idea of where the greatest flood impacts will occur in terms of people affected and approximate economic loss, so we can target future levy investments to protect certain communities. We also know where the most socially vulnerable communities are, so we can ensure investments are equitable and focused in these communities. We also know what drives flooding in different parts of the Delta and can adequately structure adaptation strategies to increase the cause. And this also, with our tools, allow us to test adaptation strategies to see how effective they would be addressing climate vulnerabilities. Now moving on to water supply. So a number of key findings here. We looked at our water supply system. We looked at what the water supply system is sensitive to and how changes in temperature, sea level rise, or precipitation affect water supply. So this is important as we develop adaptation, because we need to understand which aspects of climate change will be the most important to adapt to and which will have the greatest impact on water system resilience. And what we found that is higher temperatures pose the greatest risk. More variable precipitation is especially impactful during dry periods, and sea level rise is actually a less of a concern for water supply relative to the other factors like flooding. So higher temperatures mean more rain, less snow, and more runoff, so we can't capture runoff in reservoirs in the early months of the year as we traditionally have. Also, more variable precipitation means there'll be more years that will be wet, more years that will be dry, and fewer years that will be average. So what this means is that additional wet years won't provide much benefit with the system that we have today, because we can't capture that additional runoff. And the additional dry years intensify and expand drought-like conditions. But now we know that one possible adaptation is to perhaps capture additional runoff for use in dry years. And on to the next slide, some couple of additional findings for water supply. Not surprising, overall, we found that climate change will reduce Delta exports in all years, but impacts will be disproportionately greater in those dry years. Climate change will also chronically reduce reservoir storage in all years, meaning less water can be carried over from year to year, and increasing vulnerability to droughts and impacts when they do occur. So all of this means greater water shortages, especially in dry years, and generally a lower reliability of Delta water. This calls for Delta water users to continue their efforts to plan for future drought conditions, because when they need Delta water the most, Delta water will likely be reduced substantially. And with dry years getting worse, the drought we experienced in 2012 to 2016 will be 5 to 7 times more likely to occur in 2050. And the degree to which an extremely severe drought like this would occur is a cause for concern and calls for additional planning. And now, lastly, I'm going to hit on ecosystem. For this analysis, we looked at the vulnerability of ecosystems to local temperatures and precipitation changes and sea level rise. We looked at both unlevied ecosystems, which are connected to water. Here's a picture on the left, and levied ecosystems that are disconnected to water. And there are far more levied ecosystems located in the Delta. And moving on to the next slide of the key findings, there are a number of findings that we made in ecosystem analysis and actually throughout all of the other technical analyses, but I only focused on the most important ones today in the interest of time, and I'm only going to talk about the impacts due to sea level rise for the ecosystem analysis. And what we found is that both levied and unlevied ecosystems are at risk to sea level rise. Many islands are subsided and levied ecosystems are lost when the island floods, but there are levee management actions related to pumping of the islands dry or increasing those levee heights that can mitigate sea level rise impacts. But these interventions are not possible in unlevied areas. And the unlevied tidal wetland ecosystems have some inherent resilience because they can accrete and in some places shift upland. However, these current tidal wetlands, which are critical to the ecological health of the Delta, are not adjacent to upland areas, putting them at greater risk. Future tidal wetland restoration then must include connections to these upland transitional areas. So as a result, investments in levied ecosystems are more risky than in the unlevied ecosystems, as more investments to restore and maintain the assets will be needed in the long term. And what this also tells us is that if we are to achieve our ecosystem goals, we will need more unlevied ecosystems since they are more adaptable. And the trade-off, of course, will be balancing land used for flood control and agriculture. Also, the sooner processes are restored, the more likely it is the ecosystems will persist with continuing sea level rise. And then here, I wanted to end on the last slide and talk a little bit, really quickly, about the significance of Delta DAPS. A lot of work has already been done in the world of climate change and in the Delta, but this is the first comprehensive climate change study in the Delta and that we are undertaking. We also developed a set of comprehensive flood and water supply models that can evaluate a wide range of conditions and are flexible to new information. They're also open source, and others are welcome to use our models and include their own information. Delta DAPS also developed a socially vulnerable index, as we talked about, to identify the most socially vulnerable communities. And this allows us to really focus where our adaptation should occur in the future and in an equitable manner. We also have done extensive community engagement, including reaching out to community-based organizations to structure our efforts to include vulnerable communities. And lastly, we've worked collaboratively with our agency partners, especially the members on DPIC, in developing our methodology, sharing data so that we are consistent and verifying our results with all of you. And perhaps most importantly, to be complementary in our climate studies for the future. And that's what I have for Delta DAPS.
All right. Thank you, Harriet. Up next is Jessica Fain with the Bay Conservation and with BCDC. Jessica.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Chair Tatayan and members of the DPIC committee. I'm going to try to share my screen right now. Okay. My name is Jessica Fain. I am the Planning Director at BCDC, and I'm really pleased to be here with you today to share a little bit about what's been going on in the Bay on the adaptation front, and specifically around the topic of sea level rise. So BCDC was created in the 1960s to really manage the unregulated filling of San Francisco Bay and this fear of a shrinking bay. Fast forward to today, and sea level rise is posing quite a different challenge. A growing bay is what we are facing, and we're tasked with figuring out how to manage it. So we've been doing this for quite some time at BCDC through a variety of ways. We've been updating our policies and our Bay Plan, which is our coastal zone management regulatory tool. And we also run a program called the Adapting to Rising Tides program, which is our voluntary stakeholder-driven program, working with cities and counties and others around the Bay to assess their vulnerability to sea level rise, help them develop adaptation pathways, and develop tools for them like our Bay Shoreline Flood Explorer maps. So the most recent project that the ARCH
Jessica,
program-
hold on. This is Larry. I don't know if anybody else. I'm not getting. Is everybody able to see? And it's just me, but I'm only having the first slide up.
Uh-oh. Larry, this is Jeff. I'm seeing the same thing. Jessica, it appears the slides aren't in presentation mode.
Uh-oh.
Or advancing.
Let me try again. Thank you.
Go to slideshow.
There you go. There we go.
That's better.
Can you still see it?
Yes.
Okay, great. So Our most recent project that we completed just in March of this year is something called Art Bay Area. So this was our first time at looking really regionally at the interconnected systems across the Bay rather than looking at a specific jurisdiction. This project was a multi-year, multi-partner effort. It was funded predominantly through an SB1 Sustainable Communities grant through Caltrans. And it really served to provide definitive answers about flooding, where it occurs, when, to be a critical foundation to support and guide decision making to understand kind of these regional shared vulnerabilities. The focus of our Bay Area was on four regional systems: our transportation networks, vulnerable communities. Similar to Delta Adapts, we developed a social vulnerability index for the Bay Area and Bay Area communities. Future growth areas where we know growth is planned, as well as natural lands. And we evaluated through our Bay Area the flooding and the consequences of those impacts across the 9-county Bay Area, across what we call 10 total water levels, so 10 projected water levels of increases of sea level rise, ranging from 12 inches of sea level rise all the way up to 9 feet of sea level rise. We also, within each of these, used 32 different indicators across all of these different systems. So we looked at things like the number of daily riders that would be impacted, the different habitat types that would be impacted, contamination and where it exists, and how sea level rise might mobilize that and where that exists. And so this really helped us answer these questions about what gets wet within each system and where those impacts are worst around the region by looking at this system of consequences. And so what's at risk? What are the big takeaways? It's a big report. It's about 700 pages. It has a lot of data in it. But we know that over the next several decades, this is 48 inches of sea level rise. This could mean 5 million daily trips that couldn't be made, 60,000 daily rail commuters who won't be able to get to work. It could mean 28,000 socially vulnerable residents whose houses and housing is impacted, and potentially 13,000 existing housing units and 70,000 new planned housing units that could be inundated. It also means that there could be 100,000 existing jobs and 85,000 new jobs that could be at risk, as well as 20,000 acres of wetlands, lagoons, and tidal marshes that could be lost or drowned due to rising sea levels. So these are the things that could happen if we don't prepare the Bay Area for the impacts that we know could happen. We also identified some eight key regional planning issues, kind of these cross-cutting themes that came up. I'm not going to go through these in detail, but they include things like contamination complicating and exacerbating flooding issues. This is something I know the Ocean Protection Council is very interested in understanding better, and we'd like to get a better grasp of handle on this particular issue. Nearshore habitats and the ecosystems that they provide being sensitive early on to sea level rise, and how critical it is to get those restoration projects started if we want them to have a chance. And then also number two, which is this governance one, that sea level rise decision making is complicated by ownership, governance, and management and regulatory issues. And that's really at the heart of a lot of what is kind of going on with the region. Finally, one other analysis we did through our Bay Area is looked at these overlapping systems and identified a series of hotspots around the region where these critical assets are co-located. So these are some locations that are really ripe for coordination. They're sort of spots that point to the biggest bang for the buck, and can also kind of lead us to where, if we focus on protecting these locations, it can kind of have some cascading positive impacts across the region as well. So we got a lot of great stuff out of our Bay Area. It's hugely, it's an extremely important foundation for what could happen, and a foundation for us moving forward. But there's still the question of how, and that's sort of where our current effort, Bay Adapt, comes in. So BCDC, together with a group of Bay Area leaders from regional agencies, NGOs, and local governments, have come together to develop Bay Adapt. And what it is a short-term initiative. We sort of gave ourselves 6 months. We're sort of going on nine now. COVID hasn't really helped. But it's meant to really develop a consensus-driven strategy that lays out the actions to say, okay, we know all this stuff is going to happen, but so what? What are the top things that we should be doing about it? And at BCDC, we really see our role as leading this dialogue, not dictating the final word. So this is our website. BayAdapt, we're really in the middle of it right now, but it's comprised largely of these three key elements, a set of guiding principles that are sort of concisely articulated shared beliefs for that should guide our work. What we're calling a joint platform. So this is the top, say, 10 to 15 priority actions that the region must take. And this is sort of the roadmap of the detailed proposals of who, what, why, where, when, and how we need to do to accomplish them. And then the third component is adopting this joint platform. And this is probably the most important thing and why we've spent a lot of time thinking about our respective roles and authorities and making sure that our leadership group is really moving on along with us in this in lockstep. So as I mentioned, we started with the people. We have our leadership advisory group. We've been holding public forums. We have a group of about 100 people who are on working groups, and we've have been reaching out with elected, or our next phase is really thinking about, we'll be reaching out to elected officials and communities. And we developed these guiding principles that kind of span things like go green where appropriate, trying to really get make sure the ecosystems, ecosystem and biodiversity goals are met, but also things like, support socially vulnerable communities, and don't hold back early movers. So let's not penalize those cities and counties that are really moving ahead, but also think sufficiently long term. Ultimately, this set of actions, we've been working with these working groups. We've identified barriers, concerns, and we have gotten to the point where we have a draft set of actions that will be comprised of this joint platform, and we will be asking our leadership group to kind of sign on and commit to implementing it. So we are still in the middle of this. We have a draft of where we're going. We're going to be sharing it with our leadership group later this week. But I can share with you a little bit now on some of the initial key areas that are coming up. The first, is not surprisingly, is this notion of environmental justice and how we can prioritize the meaningful involvement of vulnerable communities in shaping adaptation futures. The second category is around local and regional adaptation. So how do we coordinate across jurisdictional boundaries to make sure that our actions are more than the sum of its parts? There's a category around funding and legislation. So these are things like developing a regional funding plan and a legislative working group. We have actions around data and science. How we can better coordinate our data and disseminate it in ways that are really two-way. And then finally, there's several actions around project implementation and how we make sure to kind of ease the pathway to implementation. So that's sort of where we are now. We'll have a lot more to share in the weeks ahead. But just one final thought before ending. Through BayAdapt, we've really been pushing for the need for our cities to think regionally. But there's obviously also the need for us to connect across regions. And there's no better example, I think, than the Bay Delta connections and the kind of conversations that we're having today. I'm really thankful for the collaborations that BCDC and the Delta Stewardship Council have had over the past year or two. Things like our ARCH East Contra Costa project is a perfect example of that. We've created new mapping tools together. We're iterating and building on each other's work. And we're also talking to each other and learning, about what each other are doing and learning from each other's mistakes. So I think these kinds of projects really create an opportunity to do more than just sit around and talk, but really dedicate the staff time to rolling up their sleeves together. And I hope we can really see more of these opportunities in the future. BCDC is updating, for example, our Sassoon Marsh Protection Plan right now to include climate change. And I think this is the perfect kind of example of where we just need to continue to be working together. So I'll end there. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Jessica. Up next is Amanda, and she's going to share with us some information about the administration's near-term priorities for climate change, with particular focus on the Bay Delta system. Amanda?
Hi, everyone. Thanks very much. Can you hear me okay? Yep. Okay. Great. Well, thank you so much for inviting me to be here. It's really nice to hear from some of you that I hear from regularly and then to meet others. So for those of you that I don't know, my name is Amanda Hansen. I work with Wade Profoot at the Natural Resources Agency and serve as his Deputy Secretary for Climate Change. And I will be brief, but just given the time, but I'll start sort of at a high level and then drill down to the most recent executive order. And then I'm happy to take any questions throughout the rest of the discussion. But, fundamentally, I would say that the governor's climate agenda is sort of driving on three things. The first is implementing the ambitious goals and commitments that we already have, accelerating those wherever possible, which is, I think many of you probably saw his press conference during which Secretary Crowfoot and Secretary Blumenfeld joined him to call for accelerated action wherever possible on climate. And then the third area that we are driving on is expanding. And so by expanding, I mean, driving on new fronts to address this challenge. And I would argue that, there's a couple areas where we're doing that very significantly. One of them is climate finance. Last year, the Department of Finance was asked to develop a climate investment framework, which they released just last month. And we've also just joined an international partnership related to climate resilient investment. So there's a lot of work being done to think about the way that we invest and how those investments can support our efforts on climate. A second area where we are really expanding our efforts is on nature-based solutions. And so I'll just take a couple minutes to walk through the most recent executive order and how we see that work moving forward. And then I'll wrap up with a couple thoughts on what's ahead in the near term. So I think it was mentioned that this executive order, the top line announcement is that it establishes a statewide goal of conserving 30% of California's lands and coastal waters by 2030. This is in response to a global scientific movement to seek commitments from countries who are part of the UN Convention on Biological Diversity to protect 30% of their land and waters, both to address the extinction crisis, but also the climate crisis. And so this executive order was really intended to be California's response and contribution to that call. So in addition to establishing the 30 by 30 goal, this executive order does a number of other, calls for a number of other actions. I won't focus as much on the biodiversity actions, just given the focus of this conversation, and I'll drill down a little bit more on climate. I would say fundamentally, this executive order really makes very clear that our lands, our natural and working lands, are a critical pillar of our climate change agenda and strategy. And, they've been a part of our approach for many years, but I think this executive order makes clear that the science is very clear. We will not achieve carbon neutrality without this sector and without driving very hard on this sector. And, one of the most exciting things about natural and working lands and nature-based solutions is that they are able to do a number of things sometimes simultaneously. So, unlike certain technologies, nature-based solutions can avoid emissions, they can sequester emissions, and they can build climate resilience, sometimes all at once. And so this is the space that the Natural Resources Agency really wants to work hard with you and with many of our sister agencies to accelerate action in. And there are sort of three pillars within the executive order that we are pushing on. The first is, the call to just accelerate action wherever we can on a number of key landscapes. Those include forests, wetlands, cities, areas that are conserved, land conservation just generally, and our agricultural lands. The second commitment within the executive order is to develop a long-term strategy so that natural and working lands is clearly part of our vision for achieving carbon neutrality and our long-term climate resilience goals. So this is a strategy that we are sort of thinking about internally at the moment and are going to essentially begin consulting and developing drafts with stakeholders and other interested parties early next year. But the goal is to deliver a product that really serves as a North Star for how our lands can contribute to climate moving forward. And I think a lot of the work that's been done and showcased today will be very helpful in contributing to that strategy. And then the third piece that the executive order does on climate is it commits to, you know, a science-based ambitious target in the scoping plan for this sector. So really exciting set of work streams ahead of us. And I'll just wrap by saying, you know, we've got, in addition to this strategy that I've just mentioned, we've got the kickoff for the state adaptation strategy next year. We are also looking at the kickoff for the 2022 scoping plan next year. So a number of sort of statewide efforts that many of these regional pieces will both, the goal is to sort of reflect and reinforce regional actions and to be as supportive as we can. So I'll wrap there and thanks again for your time.
All right, thank you, Amanda. Chair Tatayan, that concludes the panel presentations. Would very much look forward to some conversation among DPIC members about potential collaborations as well as questions for the panelists. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Chip, and thank you to all the panel members. Excellent presentations, and I see some synergies already. Are there any questions from any DPIC members for any of the panel members?
I see Campbell has his hand raised.
Hey, Campbell.
I think you're on mute, Campbell.
I keep hitting the microphone button, but then it goes right back to muting me again. Someday I'll figure that out. Thanks, everyone. Amanda, I just wanted to ask, the executive order explicitly says wetlands for protecting coastal environments. I think just for our purposes here in the Delta, we're interpreting that to mean wetlands in the Delta will contribute and be high priority. So I think that sort of goes without saying, but given the language that's in there, I just wanted to say it out loud. So otherwise, we really appreciate the focus and look forward to working with you on that.
Thank you, Campbell. Correct. And I would also add that I think we also mean mountain meadow wetlands, which are nowhere near the coast. So thanks.
Good. And maybe while I've got the mic and we're waiting for others to chime in, regarding the climate vulnerability assessment, and I apologize for not mentioning this earlier in the process, but I'm curious as to whether or not or how the both the flood maps, the ecosystem, and even the vulnerabilities accounted for ongoing subsidence. I mean, when we're looking 30 years out and even 60 years out, we're looking at somewhere between 2 and 8 feet of additional subsidence under current practices that's going to occur over that time, just increasing the head pressure on the levees. And so I was just curious as to whether or not that was incorporated in the analysis or if it's something that could be moving forward.
I think that was for me on Delta Depths, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. You know, actually, I think we took into consideration subsidence in the ecosystem amendment, but I'm not sure we did that anywhere else in terms of the height of the levees. We just assumed everything was currently. So for the flood analysis, it does not assume any additional subsidence. And for the ecosystem analysis, I believe that it does. I do have my technical leads on the call with me, So if maybe Dylan, Annika, or Andrew want to confirm or confirm that.
Hey, Harriet, this is Andrew. On the flooding analysis, we did not consider additional subsidence either on the levee heights or on the well, we only did an overtopping analysis in, for the flooding in the Delta. So the actual subsidence of the floors of the island would not have affected that analysis at all. But we do know that the levees themselves slump as well and subside. However, it's not monolithic throughout the Delta, as you know. It's faster in some places, slower in others. And so we hope to add that analysis in our adaptation studies, along with potential strategies for making improvements and maintaining those levees to keep them up.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, and from this is Dylan Chappell. From the ecosystem perspective, Campbell, we do discuss the implications of maintaining subsidence reversal projects as they relate to reducing risk. So through the lens of restoration of those ecosystems. And we're just looking at that qualitatively at this point. It's, you know, out of the scope of what we're currently doing quantitatively to figure that kind of modeling in on the ecosystem level, but it is certainly something that's discussed and highlighted. So thanks for bringing that up.
Great, thank you. Glad you guys were here to answer the question. So I see that DPIC member Tim Ramirez has his hand raised. Tim, did you have a question, comment?
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, uh-huh.
Great. Thanks to the council staff for pulling this together. Really valuable to see the different work and how it intersects in the Delta. And I really wanted to maybe just put a little flag up and thank the folks that highlighted the Lower San Joaquin and the in the Delta DAPS maps, and maybe to even connect this morning's discussion about science. You know, one of the things that the board's been talking about with DDR as the 2022 plan comes together are the assumptions we use about which data are folded into the plan, especially future hydrology conditions. You know, we're investing billions of dollars in money in the Stockton area now, knowing that more work has to be done. And to the point of looking at different scenarios and trying to be brave and think about what we use to craft those scenarios and in the end make recommendations and put the plans in motion, it's a super important discussion to have. We just started to have the discussion regionally with the regional leads on the San Joaquin. There's three different regions from the top, you know, up by Fryant and in the middle and in the bottom down by Stockton. And next year is going to be when we have those discussions in regional forums and scope some of these scenarios and talk about the trade-offs. And then the plan scheduled the course to be adopted in 2022. So really great timing and really appreciate the additional information you guys shared. I've seen some things here that I've not seen before, especially about vulnerable communities. Really important and really appreciate you guys elevating that and bringing it here. And hoping and looking forward to working with you guys as we move forward on that area in particular. Always great to see another reason to highlight this area and the need for the work in it. And it's really great to see the agencies working together to bring those things to the front with the best available information and with the factors in mind that you guys have really laid out. So I really appreciate the work and thank you very much for sharing that.
Thank you.
Great, thanks, Tim. Are there any other questions? Go ahead.
Laurel Larson has her hand up as well.
Hi, Laurel.
Hey. I really appreciated the panelists' presentations. It's a very interesting and clearly important set of work. I have a question of clarification on the vulnerability assessment for Harriet. And that question is whether the magnitude of the 100-year flood was assumed to change in the future as driven by climate models. And I just wondered if you could provide us with some more information on how those 100-year flood events were determined, or is the magnitude of a 100-year flood in the future essentially the same as it is today in these calculations, but the level of flooding actually changes because of sea level rise?
So we assumed a couple things in the flood modeling, and I'll just maybe give an overview, and if you're looking for more detail, I'll pass it off to Andrew. But essentially, we did make assumptions on future increases of sea level rise, obviously due to climate change, but we also made assumptions and increased the amount of the riverine flows. So we have made assumptions based on all the global climate models and came up with what we think is the percentage of increase, and based on other models that have been done in the Delta to determine what we should assume for those hydrologic increases in the riverine flow. So it's a combination of many things in the future. We're not using existing conditions. We're using a combination of things. And that's what we fed into the model that gives us the flood maps. Were you looking for something a little bit more detailed?
No, that addresses my question. Thank you for the clarification.
Yes, definitely.
Great. Are there any other questions from DPIC members? Well, hearing none, I have a question for Amanda. This is quite the task that you're about to embark on. And are you anticipating in developing the strategy using efforts like Bay Adapt and Delta Adapts and others, the same or similar sources of assumptions, or I know that OPC is moving forward with theirs, and I'm ignorant of all the different scenarios out there. It's just maybe perhaps DPIC could be a future venue to highlight some of the assumptions that are similar or are close to each other and being used by these various programs.
Well, what I envision is that the work that DPIC and BCDC and many other entities that have begun to think about how to adapt to climate change and where we might be able to, you know, sequester carbon on our landscapes in such a way that we can also achieve other important benefits, that those be brought into the development of the strategy so that we're not reinventing a wheel, that we're creating sort of a bringing all of the pieces together so that we have a statewide picture of what people are already driving on, what their vision is for their region, so that this strategy can really serve to support that vision, but also connect it with, statewide resources, statewide priorities. So I do think that any regional entity that is thinking about the issue of climate will become an important place for this strategy to be discussed. And I'm excited about that. And I look forward, I welcome your thoughts on sort of what would be the most useful for you and for this region, for the engagement in the development of the strategy, but also as we see it be implemented.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Yes, this is really exciting. I mean, having worked for the Nature Conservancy, I'm so excited about the nature-based solutions aspect. If there are no other questions for the panel members, from DPIC members, a question for DPIC members is in the agenda, what efforts are already happening that could be expanded or integrated? for increased Delta Bay and statewide resilience. Any suggestions might help them on to get some preliminary answers for possible integration. Well, it doesn't look like we have any suggestions yet, but we will be thinking hard on it.
Chair Tatayan, yes. Cindy Tejeda from the Army Corps just raised her hand.
Oh, great. Thanks. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, good afternoon. So I just wanted to let everyone know that there is a program that we call the Silver Jackets, which is a state-led multi-agency collaborative effort or initiative to look at flood risk management and like what we call non-structural solutions, so public education, outreach, those kinds of things. And anyway, we have an annual run for project proposals, and we have teams working in Sacramento and San Francisco looking at these kinds of issues. And I'm just particularly interested in, you know, how do we engage the socially vulnerable populations in that discussion? So I think there's some fruit there that could be, you know, fruit to bear for future conversations. I just wanted to bring that to everyone's awareness.
Thank you, Cindy. And there's actually, doesn't that program afford communities a certain recognition and rewards for meeting certain criteria?
That would be under the NFIP program through FEMA.
Okay.
We help take those initial steps to get communities to that point.
Mm-hmm.
First, you know, the first rule of order is really just understanding what the risk is and then educating people on that risk and then taking actions to reduce the risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We will keep that in mind.
Thanks.
Oh, and Tim Ramirez has his hand raised.
Maybe I jumped ahead, Susan, with my earlier comment and should have answered your question, but just to put a fine point on it, I could see some gathering maybe early next year where we try to bring some of this board forum and talk about the 2022 plan specifically and try to wrestle with some of these issues. Leslie's on the phone, our executive officer, so maybe we can put our heads together and find a way to do that and bring all this information into that venue.
Great, thank you, Tim. Well, if there are no other questions or comments from DPIC members, are there any comments from the public on this item?
Chair, there is no public comment on this item.
Great. Thank you, Eric. Well, in that case, thank you very much to all the panel members for taking the time to be with us today. And we will likely take this topic up again at another DPIC meeting, get us the DPIC leaders collaborating. This is going to be a long-term effort on all fronts. Well, with that, I think that we are at the close of the DPIC meeting, unless there are any public comments in general.
Chair, there is no public comment.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for being with us today. The next DPIC meeting will likely be in March of 2021. Fingers crossed for maybe being able to meet in person at that time. We'll see. In the meantime, be safe, take good care of your health, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye.